with a table full of leaflets, an old dartboard, and a wall liberally peppered with holes. Straight ahead was a kiosk-like front desk, protected by another metal grill. A gum-chewing woman behind the desk was reading a newspaper. She seemed suspicious and ill-disposed when Strike asked whether he could speak to a girl whose name was something like Rachel and who had been a friend of Lula Landry's.
"You a journalist?"
"No, I'm not. I'm a friend of a friend."
"Should know her name then, shouldn't you?"
"Rachel, Raquel, something like that."
A balding man strode into the kiosk behind the suspicious woman.
"I'm a private detective," said Strike, raising his voice, and the bald man looked around, interested. "Here is my card. I've been hired by Lula Landry's brother, and I need to talk to..."
"Oh, you looking for Rachel?"
asked the bald man, approaching the grill.
"She's not here, pal. She left."
His colleague, evincing some irritation at his willingness to talk to Strike, ceded her place at the counter and vanished from sight.
"When was this?"
"It'd be weeks now. Couple of months, even."
"Any idea where she went?"
"No idea, mate. Probably sleeping rough again. She's come and gone a good few times. She's a difficult character, mental health problems. Carrie Ann might know something, though. Hang on. Carrie Ann? Hey, Carrie Ann?"
The bloodless young girl with a scabbed lip came in out of the sunshine. Her eyes narrowed.
"What?"
"Rachel, have you seen her?"
"Why would I want to see that fucking bitch?"
"So you haven't seen her?"
asked the bald man.
"No, got a fag."
Strike gave her one. She put it behind her ear.
"She's still around here somewhere. Janine said she'd seen her,"
said Carrie-Anne.
"Rachel reckons she got a flat or summat, lying fucking bitch. And Lula Landry left her everything. Not. What do you want Rachel for?"
she asked Strike, and it was clear that she was wondering whether there was money in it, and whether she might do instead.
"Just to ask some questions."
"What about?"
"Lula Landry."
"Oh,"
said Carrie-Anne, and her card-counting eyes flickered.
"They weren't such big fucking mates. You don't want to believe everything Rachel says, the lying bitch."
"What did she lie about?" asked Strike.
"Fucking everything. I reckon she stole half the stuff she pretended Landry bought her."
"Come on, Carrie-Anne,"
said the bald man gently.
"They were friends,"
he told Strike.
"Landry used to come and pick her up in her car. It caused,"
he said, with a glance at Carrie-Anne,
"a bit of tension."
"Not from me, it fucking didn't,"
snapped Carrie-Anne.
"I thought Landry was a fucking jumped-up bitch. She weren't even that good-looking."
"Rachel told me she's got an aunt in Kilburn,"
said the bald man.
"She done get on with her, though,"
said the girl.
"Have you got a name or an address for the aunt?" asked Strike. But both shook their heads. "What's Rachel's surname?"
"Oh, I don't know. Do you, Carrie-Anne? We often know people just by their Christian names,"
he told Strike. There was little more to be gleaned from them. Rachel had last stayed at the hostel more than 2 months previously. The bald man knew that she had attended an outpatients clinic at St. Thomas's for a while, though he had no idea whether she still went.
"She's had psychotic episodes. She's on a lot of medication."
"She didn't give a shit when Lula died," said Carrie-Anne suddenly. "She didn't give a flying fuck."
Both men looked at her. She shrugged, as one who has simply expressed an unpalatable truth.
"Listen, if Rachel turns up again, would you give her my details and ask her to call me?"
Strike gave both of them cards, which they examined with interest. While their attention was thus engaged, he deftly twitched the gum-chewing woman's News of the World out of the small opening at the bottom of the grill and stowed it under his arm. He then bade them both a cheerful goodbye and left. It was a warm spring afternoon. Strike strode on down towards Hammersmith Bridge, its pale sage-green paint and ornate gilding picturesque in the sun. A single swan bobbed along the Thames beside the far bank. The offices and shops seemed 100 miles away. Turning right, he headed along the walkway beside the river wall
and a line of low, riverside terraced buildings, some balconied or draped in wisteria. Strike bought himself a pint in the Blue Anchor and sat outside at a wooden bench with his face to the water and his back to the royal blue and white frontage. Lighting a cigarette, he turned to page 4 of the paper, where a colour photograph of Evan Duffield, head bowed, large bunch of white flowers in his hand, black coat flapping behind him, was surmounted by the headline, "Duffield's Deathbed Visit to Lula Mother." The story was anodyne, really nothing more than an extended caption to the picture. The eyeliner and the flapping greatcoat, the slightly haunted, spaced-out expression, recalled Duffield's appearance as he had headed towards his late girlfriend's funeral. He was described, in the few lines of type below, as "troubled actor-musician Evan Duffield." Strike's mobile vibrated in his pocket, and he pulled it out. He had received a text message from an unfamiliar number. "News of the World, page 4, Evan Duffield, Robin." He grinned at the small screen before slipping the phone back in his pocket. The sun was warm on his head and shoulders, seagulls cawed, wheeling overhead, and Strike, happily aware that he was due nowhere and expected by no one, settled to read the paper from cover to cover on the sunny bench. Chapter 10. Robin stood swaying with the rest of the tightly packed commuters on a northbound Bakerloo tube train, everyone wearing the tense and doleful expressions appropriate to a Monday morning. She felt the phone in her coat pocket buzz, and extricated it with difficulty, her elbow pressing unpleasantly into some unspecified flabby portion of a suited, bad-breathed man beside her. When she saw that the message was from Strike, she felt momentarily excited, nearly as excited as she had been to see Duffield in the paper yesterday. Then she scrolled down and read, "Out. Key behind cistern of toilet. Strike." She did not force the phone back into her pocket, but continued to clutch it as the train rattled on through dark tunnels, and she tried not to breathe in the flabby man's halitosis. She was disgruntled. The previous day, she and Matthew had eaten lunch, in company with two university friends of Matthew's, at his favourite gastropub, the Windmill, on the Common. When Robin had spotted the picture of Evan Duffield in an open copy of the News of the World at a nearby table, she had made a breathless excuse right in the middle of one of Matthew's stories, and hurried outside to text Strike. Matthew had said later that she had shown bad manners, and even worse, not to explain what she was up to, in favour of maintaining that ludicrous air of mystery. Robin gripped the handstrap tightly, and as the train slowed and her heavy neighbour leaned into her, she felt both a little foolish and resentful towards the two men, most particularly the detective, who was evidently uninterested in the unusual movements of Lula Landry's ex-boyfriend. By the time she had marched through the usual chaos and debris to Denmark Street, extracted the key from behind the cistern as instructed, and been snubbed yet again by a superior-sounding girl in Freddy Bestigui's office, Robin was in a thoroughly bad temper. Though he did not know it, Strike was, at that very moment, passing the scene of the most romantic moments of Robin's life. The steps below the statue of Eros were swarming with Italian teenagers this morning, as Strike went by on the St. James's side, heading for Glasshouse Street. The entrance to Barrack, the nightclub which had so pleased D.B. Mack that he had remained there for hours, fresh off the plane from Los Angeles, was only a short walk from Piccadilly Circus. The facade looked as if it was made out of industrial concrete, and the name was picked out in shining black letters, vertically placed. The club extended up over 4 floors. As Strike had expected, its doorway was surmounted by CCTV cameras, whose range, he thought, would cover most of the street. He walked around the building, noting the fire exits, and making for himself a rough sketch of the area. After a second long internet session the previous evening, Strike felt that he had a thorough grasp of the subject of D.B. Mack's publicly declared interest in Lula Landry. The rapper had mentioned the model in the lyrics of 3 tracks on 2 separate albums. He had also spoken about her in interviews as his ideal woman and soulmate.
It was difficult to gauge how seriously Mac intended to be taken when he made these comments. Allowance had to be made, in all the print interviews Strike had read, firstly for the rapper's sense of humour, which was both dry and sly, and secondly, for the awe tinged with fear every interviewer seemed to feel when confronted with him. An ex-gang member, who had been imprisoned for gun and drug offences in his native Los Angeles, Mac was now a multimillionaire, with a number of lucrative businesses aside from his recording career. There was no doubt that the press had become excited, to use Robin's word, when news had leaked out that Mac's record company had rented him the apartment below Lula's. There had been much rabid speculation as to what might happen when D.B. Mac found himself a floor away from his supposed dream woman, and how this incendiary new element might affect the volatile relationship between Landry and Duffield. These non-stories had all been peppered with undoubtedly spurious comments from friends of both. He's already called her and asked her to dinner. She's preparing a small party for him in her flat when he hits London. Such speculation had almost eclipsed the flurry of outraged comment from sundry columnists that the twice-convicted Mac, whose music, they said, glorified his criminal past, was entering the country at all. When he had decided that the street surrounding Barrack had no more to tell him, Strike continued on foot, making notes of yellow lines in the vicinity, of Friday night parking restrictions, and of those establishments nearby that also had their own security cameras. His notes complete, he felt that he had earned a cup of tea and a bacon roll on expenses, both of which he enjoyed in a small cafe, while reading an abandoned copy of the Daily Mail. His mobile rang as he was starting his second cup of tea, halfway through a gleeful account of the Prime Minister's gaffe in calling an elderly female voter bigoted, without realising that his microphone was still turned on. A week ago, Strike had allowed his unwanted temps calls to go to voicemail. Today, he picked up.
"Hi, Robin. How are you?"
"Fine. I'm just calling to give you your messages."
"Far away," said Strike, as he drew out a pen.
"Alison Cresswell's just called, John Bristow's secretary, to say she's booked a table at Cipriani at 1 o'clock tomorrow so that he can introduce you to Tansy Bastigui."
"Great."
"I've tried Freddie Bastigui's production company again. They're getting irritated. They say he's in L.A. I've left another request for him to call you."
"Good."
"And Peter Gillespie's telephoned again."
"Uh-huh," said Strike.
"He says it's urgent, and could you please get back to him as soon as possible?" Strike considered asking her to call Gillespie back and tell him to go and fuck himself.
"Yeah, will do. Listen, could you text me the address of the nightclub Uzi?"
"Right."
"And try and find a number for a bloke called Guy Sumay. He's a designer."
"It's pronounced Guy," said Robin.
"What?"
"His Christian name. It's pronounced the French way. Guy."
"Oh, right. Well, could you try and find a contact number for him?"
"Fine," said Robin.
"Ask him if he'd be prepared to talk to me. Leave a message saying who I am and who's hired me."
"Fine." It was borne in on Strike that Robin's tone was frosty. After a second or two, he thought he might know why.
"By the way, thanks for that text you sent yesterday," he said. "Sorry I didn't get back to you. It would have looked strange if I'd started texting where I was. But if you could call Nigel Clements, Duffield's agent, and ask for an appointment, that would be great too."
Her animosity fell away at once, as he had meant it to. Her voice was many degrees warmer when she spoke again, verging, in fact, on excited.
"But Duffield can't have had anything to do with it, can he? He had a cast-iron alibi."
"Yeah, well, we'll see about that," said Strike, deliberately ominous. "And listen, Robin, if another death threat comes in, they usually arrive on Mondays."
"Yes,"
she said eagerly.
"File it," said Strike.
He could not be sure. It seemed unlikely she struck him as so prim. But he thought he heard her mutter, "Sod you, then," as she hung up.
Strike spent the rest of the day engaged in tedious but necessary spade work. When Robin had texted him the address, he visited his second nightclub of the day, this time in South Kensington. The contrast with Barrack was extreme. Uzi's discreet entrance might have been to a smart private house. There were security cameras over its doors, too. Strike then took a bus to Charles Street, where he was fairly sure Guy Sommet lived, and walked what he guessed to be the most direct route between the designer's address and the house where Landry had died. His leg was aching badly again by late afternoon, and he stopped for a rest and more sandwiches before setting out for the Feathers near Scotland Yard and his appointment with Eric Wardle. It was another Victorian pub, this time with enormous windows reaching almost from floor to ceiling, looking out onto a great grey 1920s building decorated with statues by Jacob Epstein. The nearest of these sat over the doors and stared down through the pub windows. A fierce, seated deity was being embraced by his infant son, whose body was weirdly twisted back on itself to show his genitalia. Time had eroded all shock value. Inside the Feathers, machines were clinking and jingling and flashing primary coloured lights. The wall-mounted plasma TVs, surrounded with padded leather, were showing West Bromwich Albion versus Chelsea with the sound off, while Amy Winehouse throbbed and moaned from hidden speakers. The names of ales were painted on the cream wall above the long bar, which faced a wide, dark wood staircase with curving steps and shining brass handrails leading up to the first floor. Strike had to wait to be served, giving him time to look around. The place was full of men, most of whom had military short hair. But a trio of girls with tangerine tans stood around a high table, throwing back their over-straightened peroxide hair in their tiny, tight, spangled dresses, shifting their weight unnecessarily on their teetering heels. They were pretending not to know that the only solitary drinker, a handsome, boyish man in a leather jacket, who was sitting on a high bar seat beside the nearby window, was examining them, point by point, with a practiced eye. Strike bought himself a pint of Doom Bar and approached their appraiser. "Cormorant Strike," he said, reaching Wardle's table. Wardle had the kind of hair Strike envied in other men. Nobody would ever have called Wardle pubehead.
"Yeah, I thought it might be you," said the policeman, shaking hands. "Anstis said you were a big bloke."
Strike pulled up a bar stool, and Wardle said, without preamble,
"What have you got for me, then?" "There was a fatal stabbing just off Ealing Broadway last month. Guy called Liam Yates. Police informant, wasn't he?"
"Yeah, he got a knife in the neck, but we know who did it," said Wardle with a patronising laugh.
"Half the crooks in London know. If that's your information. Don't know where he is, though, do you?"
With a quick glance at the determinedly unconscious girls, Wardle slid a notebook out of his pocket.
"Go on." "There's a girl who works in Betbusters on the Acne Road called Shona Holland. She lives in a rented flat two streets away from the bookies. She's got an unwelcome house guest at the moment called Brett Fernie, who used to beat up her sister. Apparently he's not the sort of bloke you refuse a favour."
"Got the full address?" asked Wardle, who was scribbling hard.
"I've just given you the name of the tenant and half the postcode. How about trying a bit of detective work?"
"And where did you say you got this?" asked Wardle, still jotting rapidly with the notebook balanced under the table on his knee.
"I didn't," replied Strike, equably, sipping his beer.
"Got some interesting friends, haven't you?"
"Very. Now, in a spirit of fair exchange..."
Wardle, replacing his notebook in his pocket, laughed.
"What you've just given me might be a crock of shit."
"It isn't. Play fair, Wardle." The policeman eyed Strike for a moment, apparently torn between amusement and suspicion.
"What are you after, then?"
"I told you on the phone.
Bit of inside information on Lula Landry."
"Don't you read the papers?"
"Inside information," I said. "My client thinks there was foul play."
Wardle's expression hardened. Hooked up with a tabloid, have we?
No, said Strike. Her brother.
John Bristow.
Wardle took a long pull on his pint, his eyes on the upper thighs of the nearest girl, his wedding ring reflecting red lights from the pinball machine.
Is he still fixated on the CCTV footage?
He mentioned it, admitted Strike.
We tried to trace him, said Wardle. Those two black guys. We put out an appeal. Neither of them turned up.
No big surprise. A car alarm went off just about the time they would have been passing it, or trying to get into it. Maserati, very tasty.
Reckon they were nicking cars, do you?
I don't say they went there specifically to nick cars. They might have spotted an opportunity, seeing it parked there. What kind of tosser leaves a Maserati parked on a street? But it was nearly 2 in the morning, the temperature was below zero, and I can't think of many innocent reasons why two men would choose to meet at that time in a Mayfair street where neither of them, as far as we could find out, lived. No idea where they came from, or where they went afterwards. We're pretty sure the one Bristow's obsessed with, the one who was walking towards her flat just before she fell, got off the number 38 bus in Wilton Street at 11:15. There's no saying what he did before he passed the camera at the end of Bellamy Road an hour and a half later. He tanked back past it about 10 minutes after Landry jumped, sprinted up Bellamy Road and most probably turned right down Weldon Street. There's some footage of a guy more or less meeting his description. Tall, black, hoodie, scarf round the face, caught on Theobald's Road about 20 minutes later.
We made good time if he got to Theobald's Road in 20 minutes, commented Strike. That's out towards Clerkenwell, isn't it? Must be 2, 2.5 miles. And the pavements were frozen.
Yeah, well, it might not have been him. The footage was shit. Bristow thought it was very suspicious that he had his face covered, but it was -10 that night, and I was wearing a balaclava to work myself. Anyway, whether he was in Theobald's Road or not, nobody ever came forward to say they'd recognised him.
And the other one?
Sprinted off down Halliwell Street, about 200 yards down. No idea where he went after that.
Or when he entered the area.
Could have come from anywhere. We haven't got any other footage of him.
Aren't there supposed to be 10,000 CCTV cameras in London?
They aren't everywhere yet. Cameras aren't the answer to our problems unless they're maintained and monitored. The one in Garryman Street was out, and there aren't any in Meadowfield Road or Hartley Street.
You're like everyone else, Strike. You want your civil liberties when you've told the missus you're at the office and you're at a lap dancing club, but you want 24-hour surveillance on your house when someone's trying to force your bathroom window open. Can't have it both ways.
I'm not after it either way, said Strike. I'm just asking what you know about Runner 2.
Muffled up to the eyeballs like his mate. All you could see were his hands. If I'd been him and had a guilty conscience about the Maserati, I'd have holed up in a bar and exited with a bunch of other people. There's a place called Bojo's off Halliwell Street you could have gone and mingled with the punters. We checked, Wardle said, forestalling Strike's question. Nobody recognised him from the footage. They drank for a moment in silence.
Even if we'd found them, said Wardle, setting down his glass, the most we could have got from them is an eyewitness account of her jumping. There wasn't any unexplained DNA in her flat. Nobody had been in that place who shouldn't have been in there.
It isn't just the CCTV footage that's giving Bristow ideas, said Strike. He's been seeing a bit of Tansy Bestigui.
Don't talk to me about Tansy fucking Bestigui, said Wardle irritably.
I'm going to have to mention her because my client reckons she's telling the truth.
Still at it, is she? Still hasn't given it up?
I'll tell you about Mrs. Bestigui, shall I?
Go on, said Strike, one hand wrapped around the beer at his chest.
Carver and I got to the scene about 20-25 minutes after Landry hit the road. Uniformed police were already there. Tansy Bestigui was still going strong with the hysterics when we saw her, gibbering and shaking and screaming that there was a murderer in the building. Her story was that she got up out of bed around 2 and went for a pee in the bathroom. She heard shouting from 2 flats above and saw Landry's body fall past the window. Now, the windows in those flats are triple glazed or something. They're designed to keep the heat and the air conditioning in and the noise of the hoi polloi out. By the time we were interviewing her, the street below was full of panda cars and neighbours, but you'd never have known it from up there, except for the flashing blue lights. We could have been inside a fucking pyramid for all the noise that got inside that place. So I said to her, "Are you sure you heard shouting, Mrs. Bastigui? Because this flat seems to be pretty much soundproofed." She wouldn't back down. Swore she'd heard every word. According to her, Landry screamed something like, "You're too late." And a man's voice said, "You're a fucking liar." "Auditory hallucinations, they call them," said Wardle. "You start hearing things when you snort so much coke your brain start dribbling out your nose." He took another long pull on his pint. "Anyway, we proved beyond doubt she couldn't have heard it. The Bastiguis moved into a friend's house the next day to get away from the press, so we put a few blokes in their flat and a guy up on Landry's balcony shouting his head off. The lot on the first floor couldn't hear a word he was saying, and they were stone-cold sober and making an effort. But while we were proving she was talking shit, Mrs. Bastigui was phoning half of London to tell them she was the sole witness to the murder of Lula Landry. The press were already onto it, because some of the neighbours had heard her screaming about an intruder. Papers had tried and convicted Evan Duffield before we even got back to Mrs. Bastigui. We put it to her that we'd now proven she couldn't have heard what she said she'd heard. Well, she wasn't ready to admit it had all been in her own head. She got a lot riding on it now, with the press swarming outside her front door like she was Lula Landry reborn. So she came back with, "Oh, didn't I say? I opened them. Yeah, I opened the windows for a breath of fresh air." Wardle gave a scathing laugh. "Sub-zero outside and snowing." "And she was in her underwear, right?" "Looking like a rake with two plastic tangerines tied to it," said Wardle. And the simile came out so easily that Strike was sure he was far from the first to have heard it. We went ahead and double-checked the news story. We dusted for prints, and right enough, she hadn't opened the windows. No prints on the latches or anywhere else. The cleaner had done them the morning before Landry died, and hadn't been in since. As the windows were locked and bolted when we arrived, there's only one conclusion to be drawn, isn't there? Mrs. Tansy Bastigui is a fucking liar. Wardle drained his glass. "Have another one," said Strike, and he headed for the bar without waiting for an answer. He noticed Wardle's curious gaze roaming over his lower legs as he returned to the table. Under different circumstances, he might have banged the prosthesis hard against the table leg and said, "It's this one." Instead, he set down two fresh pints and some pork scratchings, which to his irritation were served in a small white ramekin, and continued where they had left off. "Tansy Bastigui definitely witnessed Landry falling past the window, though, didn't she? Because Wilson reckons he heard the body fall right before Mrs. Bastigui started screaming. Maybe she saw it, but she wasn't having a pee. She was doing a couple of lines of Charlie in the bathroom. We found it there, cut and ready for her." "Left some, had she?" "Yeah. Presumably the body falling past the window put her off." "The window's visible from the bathroom?" "Yeah, well, just." "You got there pretty quickly, didn't you?" "Uniform lot were there in about 8 minutes, and Carver and I were there in about 20. Wardle lifted his glass, as though to toast the force's efficiency. "I've spoken to Wilson, the security guard," said Strike. "Yeah, he didn't do bad," said Wardle, with a trace of condescension. "It wasn't his fault he had the runs. But he didn't touch anything, and he did a proper search right after she jumped. Yeah, he did all right. He and his colleagues were a bit lazy on the door codes. People always are. Too many PIN numbers and passwords to remember. Know the feeling. Bristow's interested in the possibilities of the quarter of an hour when Wilson was in the bog. We were too for about 5 minutes, before we'd satisfied ourselves that Mrs. Bastigui was a publicity-mad cokehead. Wilson mentioned that the pool was unlocked. Can he explain how a murderer got into the pool area, or back to it, without walking right past him?" "A fucking pool," said Wardle. "Nearly as big as the one I got at my gym, and all for the use of three fucking people. A gym on the ground floor behind the security desk. Underground fucking parking. Flats done up with marble and shit like a fucking five-star hotel." The policeman sat shaking his head very slowly over the unequal distribution of wealth. different world, he said.
I'm interested in the middle flat, said Strike.
DB Max, said Wardle. And Strike was surprised to see a grin of genuine warmth spread across the policeman's face.
What about it? Did you go in there?
I had a look, but Bryant had already searched it. Empty. Windows bolted, alarm set and working properly.
Is Bryant the one who knocked into the table and smashed a big floral arrangement?
Wardle snorted.
Heard about that, did you? Mr. Bestigwe wasn't too chuffed about it. Oh, yeah. 200 white roses and a crystal vase the size of a dustbin. Apparently he'd read that Mac asks for white roses in his rider.
His rider, Wardle said, as though Strike's silence implied an ignorance of what the term meant.
Stuff they ask for in their dressing rooms. I'd have thought you'd know about this stuff.
Strike ignored the insinuation. He had hoped for better from Anstis.
Ever find out why Bestigwe wanted Mac to have roses?
Just smooching, wasn't it? Probably wanted to put Mac in a film. He was fucked off to the back teeth when he heard Bryant had ruined him, yelling the place down when he found out.
Anyone find it strange that he was upset about a bunch of flowers when his neighbours lying in the street with their head smashed in?
He's one obnoxious fucker, Bestigwe, said Wardle, with feeling. Used to people jumping to attention when he speaks. He tried treating all of us like staff till he realised that wasn't clever.
But the shouting wasn't really about the flowers. He was trying to drown out his wife, give her a chance to pull herself together. He kept forcing his way in between her and anyone who wanted to question her. Big guy as well, old Freddy.
What was he worried about?
That the longer she bawled and shook like a frozen whippet, the more bloody obvious it became that she'd been doing coke. He must have known it was lying around somewhere in the flat. He can't have been delighted to have the Met come bursting in. So he tried to distract everyone with a tantrum about his 500-quid floral arrangement. I read somewhere that he's divorcing her. I'm not surprised. He's used to the press tiptoeing round him because he's such a litigious bastard. He can't have enjoyed all the attention he got after Tansy shot her mouth off. The press made hay while they could, rehashed old stories about him throwing plates at underlings, punches in meetings. They say he paid his last wife a massive lump sum to stop her talking about his sex life in court. He's pretty well known as a prize shit.
You didn't fancy him as a suspect?
Oh, we fancied him a lot. He was on the spot and he's got a rep for violence. It never looked likely, though. If his wife knew that he'd done it or that he'd been out of the flat at the moment Landry fell, I'm betting she'd have told us so. She was out of control when we got there. But she said he'd been in bed and the bedclothes were disarranged and looked slept in. Plus, if he'd managed to sneak out of the flat without her realising it and gone up to Landry's place, we're left with the problem of how he got past Wilson. He can't have taken a lift, so he'd have passed Wilson in the stairwell coming down.
So the timings rule him out.
Wardle hesitated.
Well, it's just possible. Just. Assuming Bestigwe can move a damn sight faster than most men of his age and weight, and that he started running the moment he pushed her over. But there's still the fact that we didn't find his DNA anywhere in the flat, the question of how he got out of the flat without his wife knowing he'd gone, and the small matter of why Landry would have let him in. All her friends agreed she didn't like him.
Anyway,
Wardle finished the dregs of his pint,
Bestigwe's the kind of man who'd hire a killer if he wanted someone taken care of. He wouldn't sully his own ends.
Another one?
Wardle checked his watch.
My shout, he said, and he ambled up to the bar. The three young women standing around the high table fell silent, watching him greedily.
Wardle threw them a smirk as he walked back past with his drinks, and they glanced over at him as he resumed the bar stool beside Strike.
How do you think Wilson shapes up as a possible killer? Strike asked the policeman.
Badly, said Wardle. He couldn't have got up and down quickly enough to meet Tansy Bestigwe on the ground floor. Mind you, his CV's a crock of shit. He was employed on the basis of being ex-police, and he was never in the force.
Interesting.
Where was he?
He's been knocking around the security world for years. He admitted he'd lied to get his first job about 10 years ago, and he'd just kept it on his CV.
He seems to have liked Landry.
Yeah.
"'He's older than he looks,' said Wardle, inconsequentially. "'He's a grandfather. "'They don't show age like us, do they, Afro-Caribbeans? "'I wouldn't have put him as any older than you.' "'Strike wondered idly how old Wardle thought he was. "'You got forensics to check out her flat?'
"'Oh, yeah,' said Wardle.
"'But that was purely because the higher-ups wanted to put the thing beyond reasonable doubt. "'We knew within the first 24 hours it had to be suicide.' We went the extra mile, though, with the old fucking world watching. He spoke with poorly disguised pride. The cleaner had been through the whole place that morning. Sexy Polish girl. Crap English, but bloody thorough with a duster. So the day's print stood out good and clear. Nothing unusual. Wilson's prints were in there, presumably, because he searched the place after she fell. Yeah, but nowhere suspicious. So as far as you're concerned, there were only 3 people in the old building when she fell. D.B. Mack should have been there, but... He went straight from the airport to a nightclub, yeah, said Wardle. Again, a broad and apparently involuntary grin illuminated his face. I interviewed D.B. at Claridge's the day after she died. Massive bloke. Like you, he said, with a glance at Strike's bulky torso. Only fit. Strike took the hit without demur. Proper ex-gangster. He's been in and out of the nick in L.A. He nearly didn't get a visa to get into the U.K. He had an entourage with him, said Wardle. All hanging around the room, rings on every finger, tattoos on their necks. He was the biggest, though. One scary fucker, D.B.'d be, if you met him down an alleyway. Politer than Bastigui by 10 fucking miles. Ask me how the hell I could do my job without a gun. The policeman was beaming. Strike could not help drawing the conclusion that Eric Wardle, CID, was, in this case, as starstruck as Kieran Colobus-Jones. Wasn't a long interview, seeing as he'd only just got off a plane and never set foot inside Kentigern Gardens. Routine. I got him to sign his latest CD for me at the end, Wardle added, as though he could not help himself. That brought the house down. He loved it. The missus wanted to put it on eBay, but I'm keeping... Wardle stopped talking with an air of having given away a little more than he had intended. Amused, Strike helped himself to a handful of pork scratchings. What about Evan Duffield? Him, said Wardle. The stardust that had sparkled over the policeman's account of D.B. Mack was gone. The policeman was scowling. Little junky shit. He pissed us around from start to finish. He went straight into rehab the day after she died. I saw. Where? Priory. Where else? Fucking rest cure. So when did you interview him? Next day. But we had to find him first. His people were being as obstructive as possible. Same story as Bastigui, wasn't it? They didn't want us to know what he'd really been doing. My missus, said Wardle, scowling even harder, thinks he's sexy. You married?
No, said Strike.
Anstis told me you left the army to get married to some woman who looks like a supermodel. What was Duffield's story once you got to him? They'd had a big bust-up in the club, Uzi. Plenty of witnesses to that. She left, and his story was that he followed her, about 5 minutes later, wearing this fucking wolf mask. It covers the whole head. Lifelike, hairy thing. He told us he got it from a fashion shoot. Wardle's expression was eloquent of contempt. He liked putting this thing on to get in and out of places, to piss off the paparazzi. So after Landry left Uzi, he got in his car, he had a driver outside waiting for him, and went to Kentigern Gardens. Driver confirmed all that. Yeah, all right. Wardle corrected himself impatiently. He confirmed that he drove a man in a wolf's head who he assumed was Duffield, as he was of Duffield's height and build, and wearing what looked like Duffield's clothes, and speaking in Duffield's voice to Kentigern Gardens. But he didn't take the wolf head off on the journey. It's only about 15 minutes to her flat from Uzi. No, he didn't take it off. He's a childish little prick. So then... By Duffield's own account, he saw the paps outside her flat and decided not to go in after all. He told the driver to take him off to Soho, where he let him out. Duffield walked round the corner to his dealer's flat in Darbley Street, where he shot up.
Still wearing the wolf's head?
No, he took it off there, said Wardle.
The dealer, name of Wycliffe, is an ex-public schoolboy with a habit way worse than Duffield's. He gave a false statement agreeing that Duffield had come round at about 2:30. It was only the pair of them there, and yeah, I take long odds that Wycliffe would lie for Duffield. But a woman on the ground floor heard the doorbell ring and says she saw Duffield on the stair. Anyway, Duffield left Wycliffe's around 4 with a bloody wolf's head back on and rambled off towards the place where he thought his car and driver were waiting, except that the driver was gone. The driver claimed a misunderstanding. He thought Duffield was an arsehole. He made that clear when we took his statement. Duffield wasn't paying him. The car was on Landry's account. So then Duffield, who got no money on him, walks all the way to Kiara Porter's place in Notting Hill. We found a few people who'd seen a man wearing a wolf's head strolling along relevant streets, and there's footage of him cadging a free box of matches from a woman in an all-night garage.
Can you make out his face?
No, because he only shoved the wolf's head up to speak to her, and all you can see is its snout. She said it was Duffield, though. He got to Porter's around 4:30. She let him sleep on the sofa, and about an hour later she got the news about Landry being dead and woke him up to tell him. Cue histrionics and rehab.
You check for a suicide note? Asked Strike.
Yeah. There was nothing in the flat, nothing on her laptop, but that wasn't a surprise. She did it on the spur of the moment, didn't she? She was bipolar. She'd just argued with that little tosser and it pushed her over. Well, you know what I mean.
Wardle checked his watch and drained the last of his pint.
I'm going to have to go. The wife will be pissed off. I told her I'd only be 1/2 hour.
The overtanned girls had left without either man noticing. Out on the pavement, both lit up cigarettes.
I hate this fucking smoking, Ben, said Wardle, zipping his leather jacket up to the neck.
We got a deal, then? Asked Strike.
Cigarette between his lips, Wardle pulled on a pair of gloves.
I don't know about that.
Come on, Wardle, said Strike, handing the policeman a card, which Wardle accepted as though it were a joke item.
I've given you Brett Fearney.
Wardle laughed outright.
Not yet, you haven't.
He slipped Strike's card into a pocket, inhaled, blew smoke skywards, then shot the larger man a look compounded of curiosity and appraisal.
Yeah, all right. If we get Fearney, you can have the file.
Chapter 11.
Evan Duffield's agent says his client isn't taking any further calls or giving any interviews about Lula Landry, said Robin next morning. I did make it clear that you're not a journalist, but he was adamant. And the people in Guy Sommier's office are ruder than Freddy Bestigui's. You'd think I was trying to get an audience with the Pope.
Okay, said Strike. I'll see whether I can get at him through Bristow.
It was the first time that Robin had seen Strike in a suit. He looked, she thought, like a rugby player en route to an international, large, conventionally smart in his dark jacket and subdued tie. He was on his knees, searching through one of the cardboard boxes he had brought from Charlotte's flat. Robin was averting her gaze from his boxed-up possessions. They were still avoiding any mention of the fact that Strike was living in his office.
Aha! He said,
finally locating, from amid a pile of his mail, a bright blue envelope, the invitation to his nephew's party.
Bollocks, he added, on opening it.
What's the matter?
It doesn't say how old he is, said Strike. My nephew.
Robin was curious about Strike's relations with his family. As she had never been officially informed, however, that Strike had numerous half-brothers and sisters, a famous father and a mildly infamous mother, she bit back all questions and continued to open the day's paltry mail. Strike got up off the floor, replaced the cardboard box in a corner of the inner office, and returned to Robin.
What's that?
He asked, seeing a sheet of photocopied newsprint on the desk.
I kept it for you, she said diffidently. You said you were glad you'd seen that story about Evan Duffield. I thought you might be interested in this, if you haven't already seen it.
It was a neatly clipped article about film producer Freddy Bestigui, taken from the previous day's Evening Standard.
Excellent. I'll read that on the way to lunch with his wife.
Soon to be ex, said Robin. It's all in that article. He's not very lucky in love, Mr. Bestigui.
From what Wardle told me, he's not a very lovable man, said Strike.
How did you get that policeman to talk to you? Robin said, unable to hold back her curiosity on this point. She was desperate to learn more about the process and progress of the investigation.
We've got a mutual friend, said Strike. Bloke I knew in Afghanistan. Met officer in the TA.
You were in Afghanistan?
Yeah.
Strike was pulling on his overcoat, the folded article on Freddy Bestigui and the invitation to Jack's party between his teeth. What were you doing in Afghanistan?
Investigating a killed in action, said Strike. Military police.
Oh, said Robin.
Military police did not tally with Matthew's impression of a charlatan or a waster.
Why did you leave?
Injured, said Strike.
He had described that injury to Wilson in the starkest of terms, but he was wary of being equally frank with Robin. He could imagine her shocked expression, and he stood in no need of her sympathy.
Don't forget to call Peter Gillespie, Robin reminded him, as he headed out of the door.
Strike read the photocopied article as he rode the tube to Bond Street. Freddy Bestigui had inherited his first fortune from a father who had made a great deal of money in haulage. He had made his second by producing highly commercial films that serious critics treated with derision. The producer was currently going to court to refute claims by two newspapers that he had behaved with gross impropriety towards a young female employee whose silence he had subsequently bought. The accusations, carefully hedged around with many alleged's and reported's, included aggressive sexual advances and a degree of physical bullying. They had been made by a source close to the alleged victim, the girl herself having refused either to press charges or to speak to the press. The fact that Freddy was currently divorcing his latest wife, Tansy, was mentioned in the concluding paragraph, which ended with a reminder that the unhappy couple had been in the building on the night that Lula Landry took her own life. The reader was left with the odd impression that the Bestigui's mutual unhappiness might have influenced Landry in her decision to jump. Strike had never moved in the kinds of circles that dined at Cipriani. It was only as he walked up Davis Street, the sun warm on his back and imparting a ruddy glow to the red brick building ahead, that he thought how odd it would be, yet not unlikely, if he ran into one of his half-siblings there. Restaurants like Cipriani were part of the regular lives of Strike's father's legitimate children. He had last heard from three of them while in Selly Oak Hospital, undergoing physiotherapy. Gabby and Danny had jointly sent flowers. Al had visited once, laughing too loudly and scared of looking at the lower end of the bed. Afterwards, Charlotte had imitated Al braying and wincing. She was a good mimic. Nobody ever expected a girl that beautiful to be funny, yet she was. The interior of the restaurant had an Art Deco feeling, the bar and chairs of mellow polished wood, with pale yellow tablecloths on the circular tables and white-jacketed, bow-tied waiters and waitresses. Strike spotted his client immediately among the clattering, jabbering diners, sitting at a table set for four and talking, to Strike's surprise, to two women instead of one, both with long, glossy brown hair. Bristow's rabbity face was full of the desire to please, or perhaps placate. The lawyer jumped up to greet Strike when he saw him, and introduced Tansy Bestigui, who held out a thin, cool hand, but did not smile, and her sister, Ursula May, who did not hold out a hand at all. While the preliminaries of ordering drinks and handing around menus were navigated, Bristow, nervous and over-talkative throughout, the sisters subjected Strike to the kind of brazenly critical stares that only people of a certain class feel entitled to give. They were both as pristine and polished as life-size dolls recently removed from their cellophane boxes, rich girl thin, almost hipless in their tight jeans,
with tanned faces that had a waxy sheen especially noticeable on their foreheads, their long, gleaming dark manes with centre partings, the ends trimmed with spirit-level exactitude.
When Strike finally chose to look up from his menu, Tansy said, without preamble, "Are you really Johnny Rugby's son?"
"So the DNA test said," he replied.
She seemed uncertain whether he was being funny or rude. Her dark eyes were fractionally too close together, and the Botox and fillers could not smooth away the petulance in her expression.
"Listen, I've just been telling John," she said curtly. "I'm not going public again, okay? I'm perfectly happy to tell you what I heard, because I'd love you to prove I was right. But you mustn't tell anyone I've talked to you."
The unbuttoned neck of her thin silk shirt revealed an expanse of butterscotch skin stretched over her bony sternum, giving an unattractive, knobbly effect. Yet two full, firm breasts jutted from her narrow ribcage, as though they had been borrowed for the day from a fuller-figured friend.
"We could have met somewhere more discreet," commented Strike.
"No, it's fine, because nobody here will know who you are. You don't look anything like your father, do you? I met him at Elton's last summer. Freddie knows him. Do you see much of Johnny?"
"I've met him twice," said Strike.
"Oh,"
said Tansy. The monosyllable contained equal parts of surprise and disdain. Charlotte had had friends like this, sleek-haired, expensively educated and clothed, all of them appalled by her strange yen for the enormous, battered-looking Strike. He had come up against them for years, by phone and in person, with their clipped vowels and their stockbroker husbands, and the brittle toughness Charlotte had never been able to fake.
"I don't think she should be talking to you at all," said Ursula abruptly.
Her tone and expression would have been appropriate had Strike been a waiter who had just thrown aside his apron and joined them uninvited at the table.
"I think you're making a big mistake, Tans."
Bristow said, "Ursula, Tansy simply..." "It's up to me what I do," Tansy snapped at her sister, as though Bristow had not spoken, as though his chair was empty. "I'm only going to say what I heard, that's all. It's all off the record. John's agreed to that." Evidently, she too viewed Strike as domestic class. He was irked not only by their tone, but also by the fact that Bristow was giving witnesses assurances without his say-so. How could Tansy's evidence, which could have come from nobody but her, be kept off the record? For a few moments, all four of them ran their eyes over the culinary options in silence. Ursula was the first to put down her menu. She had already finished a glass of wine. She helped herself to another and glanced restlessly around the restaurant, her eyes lingering for a second on a blonde minor royal before passing on.
"This place used to be full of the most fabulous people, even at lunchtime. Cyprian only ever wants to go to bloody Wilton's with all the other stiffs in suits."
"Is Cyprian your husband, Mrs. May?" asked Strike.
He guessed that would needle her if he crossed what she evidently saw as an invisible line between them. She did not think that sitting at a table with her gave him a right to her conversation. She scowled, and Bristow rushed to fill the uncomfortable pause.
"Yes, Ursula's married to Cyprian May, one of our senior partners." "So I'm getting the family discount on my divorce," said Tansy, with a slightly bitter smile. "And her ex will go absolutely ballistic if she starts dragging the press back into their lives,"
Ursula said, her dark eyes boring into Strike's.
"They're trying to thrash out a settlement. It could seriously prejudice her alimony if all that kicks off again, so you'd better be discreet."
With a bland smile, Strike turned to Tansy.
"So you had a connection with Lula Landry then, Mrs. Bestigwe. Your brother-in-law works with John."
"It never came up," she said, looking bored.
The waiter returned to take their orders. When he had left, Strike took out his notebook and pen.
"What are you doing with those?"
demanded Tansy, in a sudden panic.
"I don't want anything written down. John!"
She appealed to Bristow, who turned to Strike with a flustered and apologetic expression.
"Do you think you could just listen, Cormoran, and skip the note-taking?"
No problem, said Strike easily, removing his mobile phone from his pocket and replacing the notebook and pen. Mrs. Bastigui,
you can call me Tansy, she said,
as though this concession made up for her objections to the notebook. Thanks very much, said Strike, with the merest trace of irony. How well did you know Lula?
Oh, hardly at all. She was only there for 3 months. It was just high and nice day. She wasn't interested in us. We weren't nearly hip enough for her. It was a bore, to be honest, having her there. Paps outside the front door all the time. I had to put on make-up even to go to the gym.
Isn't there a gym in the building? Asked Strike.
I do Pilates with Lindsay Parr, said Tansy irritably. You sound like Freddy. He was always complaining that I didn't use the facilities at the flat.
And how well did Freddy know Lula?
Hardly at all. But that wasn't for lack of trying. He had some idea about luring her into acting. He kept trying to invite her downstairs. She never came, though. And he followed her to Dickie Carberry's house the weekend before she died, while I was away with Ursula.
I didn't know that, said Bristow, looking startled.
Strike noticed Ursula's quick smirk at her sister. He had the impression that she had been looking for an exchange of complicit glances, but Tansy did not oblige.
I didn't know till later, Tansy told Bristow.
Yeah, Freddy catched an invitation from Dickie. There was a whole group of them there. Lula, Evan Duffield, Kiara Porter, all that tabloidy, druggy, trendy gang. Freddy must have stuck out like a sore thumb. I know he's not much older than Dickie, but he looks ancient, she added spitefully.
What did your husband tell you about the weekend?
Nothing. I only found out he'd been there weeks later because Dickie let it slip. I'm sure Freddy went to try and make up to Lula, though.
Do you mean, asked Strike, that he was interested in Lula sexually, or...
Oh, yeah, I'm sure he was. He's always liked dark girls better than blondes. What he really loves, though, is getting a bit of celebrity meat into his films. He drives directors mad, trying to crowbar in celebrities to get a bit of extra press. I'll bet he was hoping to get us signed up for a film. And I wouldn't be at all surprised, Tansy added, with unexpected shrewdness, if he had something planned around her and D.B. Mack. Imagine the press, with the fuss there was already about the two of them. Freddy's got a genius for that stuff. He loves publicity for his films as much as he hates it for himself.
Does he know D.B. Mack?
Not unless they've met since we separated. He hadn't met Mack before Lula died. God, he was thrilled that Mack was coming to stay in the building. He started talking about casting him the moment he heard.
Casting him as what?
I don't know, she said irritably. Anything. Mack's got a huge following. Freddy wasn't going to pass that chance up. He'd probably have had a part written specially for him if he'd been interested. Oh, he would have been all over him, telling him all about his pretend black grandmother.
Tansy's voice was contemptuous. That's what he always does when he meets famous black people. Tells them he's a quarter Malay. Yeah, whatever, Freddy. Isn't he a quarter Malay? Asked Strike.
She gave a snide little laugh.
I don't know. I never met any of Freddy's grandparents, did I? He's about 100 years old. I know he'll say anything if he thinks there's money in it. Did anything ever come of these plans to get Lula and Mack into his films, as far as you're aware?
Well, I'm sure Lula was flattered to be asked. Most of these model girls are dying to prove they can do something other than stare into a camera. But she never signed up to anything, did she, John?
Not as far as I know, said Bristow.
Although... But that was something different, he mumbled, turning blotchily pink again. He hesitated, then, responding to Strike's interrogative gaze, he said, Mr. Bastigui visited my mother a couple of weeks ago, out of the blue. She's exceptionally poorly, and... Well, I wouldn't want to... His glance at Tansy was uncomfortable.
Say what you like, I don't care, she said, with what seemed like genuine indifference.
Bristow made the strange jutting and sucking movement that temporarily hid the hamsterish teeth. Well, he wanted to talk to my mother about a film of Lula's life. He, framed his visit as something considerate and sensitive, asking for her family's blessing, official sanction, you know. Lula dead barely 3 months. Mum was distressed beyond measure. Unfortunately, I was not there when he called.
said Bristow, and his tone implied that he was generally to be found standing guard over his mother.
I wish in a way I had been. I wish I'd heard him out.